After Robert, okay, I'm missing that on my schedule, sorry. Okay. Okay, so welcome. So welcome to the Centre for Population Biology workshop on data archiving. So we're first of all, I should introduce Carl. I'm going to slaughter your name.
Bettiger.
Carl Bettiger of the Centre for Population Biology is the person who is just primarily responsible for putting this workshop together. And we've pulled together a wide range of people who have experience and exposure to the problem of archiving data. And let me first do some introductions, then I'll give you a sort of a few sort of motivating comments for why data archiving, and then I will hand over to our first speaker. Okay. So my name's Marcel Holyoake. I'm a faculty member here in Environmental Science and Policy, and I'm also a member of the executive board of Data Dryad, which is one of the data archives that's that one in particular is trying to interface with ecological and evolutionary journals. And then I'm also the editor-in-chief of one of the ecological journals, Ecology Letters, so I get to see the publisher's side of data archiving as well, so how individual paper contributions of data might become archived. Then I'd like to do some introductions of other people. First of all, we have some representatives here from the UC Davis Library, and I'll start off with Phoebe Ayres, is over there, and I understand there are some other librarians in here, so do please feel free to contribute.
Is Ruth Gustafson?
Hi. Hi, welcome. Do you want to introduce yourselves?
Deanna Johnson.
Welcome.
I'm Raquel Abad.
Okay, great. Well, feel free to chime in and add to the discussion, please. Then from the UC3 Data Curation Project, we have Patricia Cruz.
Hi.
And Stephen Abrams.
Oh. Yeah.
And then we have, I'm going to leave you guys to say what the UC3 data project is when you, you're far more knowledgeable than me on it, so it makes sense for you to do that when you, when you start talking. We have Jonathan Isom from the Genome Center at UC Davis and the Section of Evolution and Ecology. And Jonathan is somebody with expertise in genomic data and phylogenetic methods in particular. And so he's very used to dealing with those kind of data and interfacing with archives that are dealing with genetic and evolutionary data. So he's one of our main representatives in that area. Then we will be joined tomorrow by Alan Hastings. Alan is a theoretical ecologist and has quite a lot of experience of dealing with computer code, which represents a special problem for data archiving in terms of how to get computer code for programs and routines that is adequately, annotated and explained so that a future user could pick it up and use it. We have Robert Hymans here. Robert is a faculty member in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy. He is someone who works actively at the interface between data and modeling with respect to climate change in particular. Robert brings a huge amount of experience in the problems of working with large data sets and things like data standards and how, as a user, you can access data that's in databases and so on. So Robert will be very useful for those kind of things. Lastly, but no means least, we have Don Strong at the back here. Don is a faculty member in the Section of Evolution and Ecology at UC Davis, and he is also the editor-in-chief of one of the major journals, Ecology, and so brings also a publisher's perspective. And Don's subject area is is ecology in general, I guess, especially community and population ecology, so he brings sort of a, more of an ecologist perspective. Anything else you'd add there, Don? Good enough. Okay. So, it's really been in the last 3 or 4 years that evolutionary biologists and ecologists have become aware of the problem of data archiving and have started to actually think about doing things about this. From an evolution perspective, this started actually with the work of Michael Whitlock, who's a mid-career faculty member who had an agenda that evolutionary data that goes beyond just gene sequences and phylogenetic trees should be archived. And through working with a journal, The American Naturalist, Michael Whitlock actually created a movement where by now most of the evolutionary journals have turned to making data archiving something that is a condition of publication in those journals. The ecological journals have been talking about this for the last few years as well, but it hasn't yet become gotten to a point where it is being done as a compulsory thing. So from the perspective of an individual researcher, it creates new demands on us to think about what data archives are out there. But I think more importantly, it creates opportunities having access to large amounts of data from previous studies. There's opportunities for meta-analyses, new kinds of integrative analyses that wouldn't have been possible just based on the information that's in a published paper that ends up in print. There's also the scary thought that a lot of what we do as scientists, and you know, I guess I'm far enough along in my career now where I can remember projects where the data is more or less lost at this point. So there was public funds that went into research, and I'm not sure I could lay my hands on the particular data files from 15 years ago or some similar period. And so there's a lot of effort that goes into science that ends up being used to for a fraction of its possible value. And so harvesting some of the opportunities that are there is one of the things that we'll touch on extensively. There's also possible incentives to publish your data from the perspective of you as an author of a data set could be accruing citations of your data, much like published papers are cited. Data sets could also be cited, and there's mechanisms being set up to achieve that. And that makes it that our contribution can go beyond that in an individual paper. Not only that, if we have data that we have made available from a publication, that data can sometimes be used to check the reliability of findings in a paper. It can be that for something, a paper that's describing perhaps a new method, the ability of users to have a test data set available for that, for trying out that method, where the answers are known, could be very valuable in enhancing the adoption of such a data, such a method. So, we're going to touch on a wide range of issues. I'll just sort of spark a few more ideas of things that are the kind of things we come up against when thinking about data archiving. There's the question of whether data archives are truly permanent or not, and how do we as a society achieve that? What is required to do it? There's questions of data standards, making data discoverable and accessible, and what kinds of things like meta-language and so on are necessary to achieve that. Then there's potential problems we encounter as users of of these databases. If we are putting our data out there, does that mean we lose future research opportunities? Does it mean that we are at risk of being scooped by somebody else who then takes our data set and does something else with it? How can we get around those kind of potential pitfalls? And at the moment, it's that most data archives are sort of post-research archives, and we'll talk a bit more about different types of archives later, but there aren't many archives that are out there that are also working databases where we put our data in that portal at the time of conducting our study and can then be accessed by multiple users. And the transition from a working data set to an archived data set is facilitated if that is the case. So that's the kind of thing that might be possible. Then the ability to check the reliability of studies creates potential concerns from researchers. It's sort of like, how do I know I got the right answer? But there are possibilities of added value there. So for example, I believe it's the Journal of Biostatistics has introduced a notation on papers to say whether code was submitted, and they have an associate editor for reproducibility. They would take your code and your data and try and run the statistics on it again. And if they get the same answer, you get a notation on your paper that this has been done, a stamp of quality, as it were. If you submit your code or your data and they can't get the same answer, you get a lesser mark of just for having submitted the code or data. It's showing that you're at least open to that. Okay. So there's possibilities of verifying the reliability of studies that come with data archiving. So looking ahead to the next 3 days, so today we're aiming to sort of introduce the different elements of archiving and explain why we archive, what some of the pros and cons are for doing that, as well as talking about some of the databases that are available and issues like that. Then tomorrow we concentrate more on methodological issues of how do we leverage data archives to make them most user-friendly to those who are depositing data, to make data most discoverable and accessible. And so mainly methodological things is the intention tomorrow. And then on Friday, we take a more prospective look forward as to what kinds of new science might be possible with the advent of data archives. So I would like to hand over to, is it Stephen going to present or Patricia? Okay, right. So Patricia, yes.
Is there going to be Truman. A moment where there's going to be kind of, here's a list of places people archive and pluses and minuses of those places? And
I'm scheduled to do that, but it's not until about 3/4 of the way through the...
I was listening to your list, and I was listening to that. So that will be today?
That will be today, yeah. I have a few slides on that, and it's not a completely encyclopedic list. It's more giving the flavor of different kinds of archives and mentioning some of the major ones.
Okay.
You'll hear about one mechanism that's being promoted almost immediately from Patricia and Stephen on this. Okay, so Patricia. I think you need to stand here to be in.
Yeah, to be in the. So it's great to be here today, and it's also just terrific to hear people talking about data archiving and data curation and citation. This is just really exciting. It's things that we've been talking about at the UC Curation Center, which is part of the California Digital Library. And I just want to give a microcosm. Talk about why the UC Curation Center exists and how we came into being. At libraries, we have been archiving information for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so we have taken the next step of thinking about how we can archive research data. A lot of what we do at the California Digital Library has applicability to the research world. But about 2 years ago, we found that the amount of data that was coming our way was incredibly huge, incredibly diverse. We had users asking for new ways to do things with the data. And we also recognized that we were in a huge budget crunch, so we needed to do something very different. And so out of that came the UC Curation Center. And we work collaboratively with all of the campuses around the University of California. We work with researchers, data centers, museums, and archives. And our goal is to help manage and preserve the intellectual output of the University of California. That's a huge goal. We recognize that. But I just want to share with you some of the things that we do work on. Some of the things that we've thought about is how we can respond technically to that challenge, and how we can respond organizationally, and within that, how we can build new communities of practice to gather around the problems of archiving and managing data. It's a huge job, and it's not just the libraries that are going to do it. It's not just the researchers, and it's not the data centers. And I think it demands the university to look at this problem in a whole new way. And that's what we're proposing at the UC Curation Center, to bringing these new communities together to address this problem. Some of the things that we're working on at the UC Curation Center, my colleague Stephen Abrams is going to talk about one of them, is Merit, which is a repository that we just rolled out in September, I think it was September 15th at about 4:30 in the afternoon. That's a way, it's a service that allows you to manage, archive, share, and provide access to your data. And it's targeted for UC researchers and faculty to put their data in. It's open to the UC community, but it's also open to external users. So we recognize that researchers, they don't work within their institution, they work within their discipline. And so it's really important for somebody who's at the University of California to be able to work with somebody at the University of Colorado. We also have something called the Easy ID service, and that you were talking about citation and tracking citations and getting credit for your work. The Easy ID service is, my colleague John Kunze will talk about tomorrow, lets you assign DOIs, register those DOIs, they end up in the Web of Science, they can be exposed on Google. It's a way of getting your research out there, and also getting those statistics about the use of your research. We also are very involved in the Data One project. I'm on the leadership team with Data One, and we talk a lot about the issues that that are going to be talked about in over the next 3 days. One of the things that this group might be interested in, we just completed a survey of faculty and researchers of their attitudes of sharing data. Why do they want to share, and when do they want to share? And so we had about 1,500 respondents, which we thought was a pretty good response rate. And so we do have a lot of information that we are making available to the community to understand what are the barriers to sharing data, why do people share, and when do they not want to share. One of the biggest reasons is my data will be misrepresented and I won't get credit for it. So I think our challenge is to overcome those things. How do we address those issues? Some of the other things that we're involved in, we have funding from Microsoft Research and from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation to make Microsoft Excel friendly for archiving and sharing data and preserving data. I know people think, Microsoft Excel, that's not a preservation tool. Bottom line is people use Microsoft Excel all the time. And if we can make it easy for people to preserve the data that comes out of Microsoft Excel and easy for them to publish and share that data, I think we're going to make a big step forward. This is an open source tool, so that's great for the open source community. We're also working on something called data papers or data publication. And I think, again, this was mentioned in the opening remarks, of what does it mean to just publish a data paper? What are the components of a data paper? How do you get credit for that data paper? So my colleague John Kunze is going to talk about that tomorrow. So I invite you all to visit our webpage and to listen to the various talks that we have. Oh, one other thing that we are doing is some of you are aware of the NSF. On January 18th, they said any NSF proposal has to have a data management plan along with it. We are actively engaged in developing data management plans for anybody that needs help in that area. We're developing a tool, an online tool that will generate those data management plans based on some questions and some answers, et cetera. But right now, we don't have that tool up and running, but we have some model plans that we can send your way. We know the language to put in there, or we think we know the language to put in there. So if anybody needs help in that area, we're happy to help with that. So does anybody have any questions about who we are and what we do and where we live? Yeah.
How much of the money for you comes from the UC versus from grants, and what are the future plans for that money?
Well, we actively pursue grant funding for all of our development efforts, but we also, I wasn't going to get into this, but I will, is that for things like merit and some of our other services, it's a fee for service for the external to the University of California, so we offset our costs that way. We pay for developers internally by charging for our services externally to the university. For our funding, about I would say a third of our funding is on soft money for our staff, but we are all on firm funding, and we think that's the way for preservation. Having soft money for preservation gets a little bit, it's kind of like a house of cards on quicksand, but anyways.
Yeah. So data, you're talking about all kinds of data, not just numbers. You're talking about
nice definition of what data is, and NSF has a nice data definition, but it's really anything from images to text to Excel spreadsheets to videos to, so it's a really a wide range of content. So
are you promoting the data that's archived should be it should be indexed with metadata in particular ways, or is it more freeform? Or
I would say yes to all of that. What we have found is that if you tell people that they have to create this, this amount of metadata, you're often not going to get the data and it will be lost. If you say the only thing you have to do is tell me what it is, who created it, when it was created, and we'll assign a persistent identifier to it, and we can squirrel away here until somebody has more time to create some really nice descriptive metadata for broader use, then that's good enough. If somebody is planning to put it in to something that has a full-blown access system that does require that more extensive metadata, then we will promote that as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
No. So all of the above. Yeah, way back there.
Do you have a web page in the code about contact information?
Yes. If you Google UC3 at CDL, you should be able to find it, and there we have contact information there. And I should add that we work extensively with the UC Davis Library. So anytime you contact us, you're also contacting them. So we work together. And like I said, this is a huge arena, and we're all kind of tag-teaming on how to address this issue.
And Trish, I'll just say, if anyone wants to contact us locally, there's four librarians here, and we're all four working on this issue in particular.
Okay.
So you can always talk to us, and I can help you get in touch.
There's one other thing I want to add, and this is a little bit of a soapbox issue, and I was sharing with Don Strong before we started, is one of the things that's really important to libraries is as we try to manage the intellectual output of the university, we increasingly are paying more and more for journals. It's been very public how much we pay for Nature, how much those Elsevier titles are, et cetera. We don't want to get into the position of 5 years from now, Elsevier comes to us and says, well, there's all these data sets associated with these journal articles, but you're going to have to pay for them. We want to be able to control our intellectual output. And so that is really important to the sustainability of the organization and scholarship. So that's my last bit of soapbox. So.
It's more than a soapbox.
Yeah.
It's the future of the endeavor. It's not some sort of side issue.
I agree.
It is central to the issue. And commercial publishing has acted in a way that has been described all the way from irresponsible to predatory. Mm-hmm. And we have sort of lay there for 15 years and let them have their way, take their pleasure with us. And it's an extremely serious issue.
And I think through our tools that you'll hear about, and also through the e-scholarship program, that you'll see that we do have a lot of solutions that will help address a lot of these issues. And we're open to working with the community to make our solutions better, to better meet your needs, et cetera. This is a dialogue, and it's early days, so.
Can I ask you to say a few words about the extent to which things like Merit will be linked up with other databases around the world? Is there going to be a handshaking process so that you could search one database and find things in other databases, those kind of things?
So that's a little bit of my colleague Stephen's going to talk about, but for example, Merit, we will be creating a plugin for Merit that will automatically connect it to Data One. We're working with the other big DataNet project, the Data Conservancy, et cetera. We think it's, like I said, we understand that researchers don't work within their institution, they work within their discipline. So it's really important to be able to link up that way. And that's, I think, one of the ways when Merit was designed, the thinking that we need to be able to integrate with other resources. So with that.
Thanks, Tricia. As Tricia mentioned, Merit is the name of our new repository service offering that is we rolled out back in September of last year. We've actually been in the repository business for about 8 or 9 years, so Merit really represents the latest generation of our thinking, as well as the thinking of the larger digital preservation and curation communities. And we think that it provides a very good platform for a cost-effective service that will allow you, as members of the UC community, to manage and share and preserve the valuable digital content that results from your research and teaching activities. And in this, we recognize that it's sort of the digital information technology is really transforming what scholarship means, and there are a lot of new modes of teaching, of research, and certainly new modes of publication. And we've tried very hard to make sure that Merit is well positioned to support these various new modes. Now, within the UC library system, we underwent a fairly large task of thinking about this and coming up with a strategic report. And three of the main findings of that report were that the university as a whole needs to deploy effective technology solutions in these three areas, being able to capture a significant percentage, if not all, ideally, of new content streams that are arising from research and teaching activities, that the campuses are provided with an effective infrastructure for managing and sharing and preserving those collections, and also enabling easy discovery and use. So let's take a look at how we think Merit stacks up in these three regards. In terms of being able to deal with a variety of new content streams, first off, Merit is content agnostic. We can take in content from any discipline, and in any particular form that you want to give it to us. And that content can be accompanied by any type of metadata, or in fact, no metadata at all, although generally we wouldn't recommend that. because while we say that all forms of content are acceptable for admission into the repository, there are particular forms that we would consider to be preferable, that are more inherently preservable over archival time periods. And we are able to offer guidance and best practice recommendations for the creation of content that we think will, in fact, be inherently long-lived. We've also spent a great deal of our development time on Merit in trying to simplify all of our workflows and our submission workflows in particular. We've been operating a repository service for about 8 years. The previous repository, it worked well, but in fact it was a little bit cumbersome, and particularly cumbersome as to the submission workflows. So what we tried to do is looked at a lot of new social media websites like Flickr, YouTube, and we're sort of taking that as our benchmark for deciding what an appropriate user interface, especially for submission, should be. And we think, in fact, that we've been able to do that. It's a very simple, just give us the name of the file, it comes in, and that's minimally all you have to do. There's a lot more that you could do, but you don't have to.
Is there a size constraint?
Technically there are no size constraints. Obviously, when we're dealing with scientific data, that we're talking about a very different scale than sort of the traditional cultural heritage material that we in the libraries have always dealt with. So if you're talking up in terabyte scale data, we need a certain amount of lead time in order to procure the necessary underlying storage. But the system itself, there is really no effective constraint on size.
Can you say a bit more about that interface? You say that modeling after social media, you're looking into interfaces to,
yep,
to upload and pull down data.
Yes. Yes. So the next area that our task force report had talked about was easy discovery and use. So some of this Tricia already mentioned. Merit does provide identifiers for persistent reference, using our EZID service, which is actually a standalone service for managing preservation identifiers, but in fact it is fairly tightly coupled within Merit, so that anything that is submitted to Merit that does not come into us with an appropriate identifier, we will mint an identifier for that purpose at the point of ingest. Also, we mentioned the DataCite initiative. UC3 is a founding member of the DataCite Consortium, which is involved in promoting data standards and technical systems that will allow the linking of publication, of traditional text-based publications, with their underlying research data. And if you come back tomorrow afternoon, you will hear more about that from John Kunze. All of the metadata that we collect from a variety of sources is stored and managed in a single comprehensive metadata catalog that exposes that data semantically according to the linked data paradigm. So what we're trying to do is position Merit to play very well in the evolving semantic web that is sort of rapidly overtaking the internet and the web of today, which is primarily still a web of documents and static links to those documents. Content and metadata retrieval, for that matter, can occur at a variety of levels. There is a certain amount of data modeling that's going on within the repository. The primary entity involved is what we call a digital object. An object can be made up of an arbitrary number of versions, because Merit is strongly versioned, and essentially any change to object state will result in the creation of a new version of that object. And we maintain all of those versions over time so that we can track changes to content or metadata as that continues to evolve. A version itself can be made up of an arbitrary number of files that collectively represent the state of that object at a particular point in time. So we can perform retrieval at the object level, at a particular version level, or down to the individual file level. And in fact, above the object level, there's a notion of collection, so that you can aggregate together an arbitrary set of objects into one or more collections that can be defined to meet a variety of administrative or curatorial purposes. So with all of that, we believe that Merit provides a good way for you to take control of your content and to decide how you want to provide access to how and to whom you want to provide that access to. It's an effective means for sharing your data with others. It can go a long way towards meeting the data sustainability requirements that are increasingly becoming necessary by various grant funding agencies. And this is really important. As Tricia mentioned, there's a lot of money at stake, $600 million UC-wide from NSF. That's actually 2 years ago. And of course, we feel it provides a good platform for the managed long-term preservation of important research data. And there's a whole host of technical solutions and various activities and processes that we put into place here in order to ensure the long-term viability of the data that's managed within the repository. This we've already, Tricia already mentioned this. The use of Merit is available to any member of the UC community. Historically at the CDL, we've worked very closely with the campus, libraries, archives, and museums, but certainly over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been increasingly dealing with new campus constituencies, academic departments, to some degree, to a very large degree, various research groups. On campuses as well as data centers. And in fact, we also offer our services to content partners outside of the university in a variety of sectors. So here is just a short, actually, but illustrative list of some of the people that and the types of data that we are working with. Including various colleagues of ours within the CDL. eScholarship is the open access publishing program at the CDL. It provides a place for faculty and students to for open access publishing of various sorts. We are getting a copy of all that material. It's coming into us in order to serve as a preservation copy. In addition to the access copies that are made directly available through eScholarship. Open Context is a large multi-institutional project that is dealing with the management of archaeological data. We're dealing with the Minnesota Historical Society, which is the official state archives of Minnesota. And actually, they're just the lead institution, again, on a multi-state project that is looking at archiving legislative history, including the California Legislative Library. On the Berkeley campus, we're working with the Research Hub program that is dealing with a variety of museum collections, both in the areas of fine arts collections as well as some of the science museums. Riverside, we're dealing with the California Newspaper Collection, as well as the Water Resource Center Archive that is newly moved down there, and a number of other things. Tricia already mentioned Data One. We are a partner on the Data One project, and Merit will become a member node in the Data One network. Probably later this year, that will start to become effective. And then within UC3 itself, another programmatic area that Tricia didn't mention in her introduction is our web archiving service. This is a tool that allows curators to go out and collect material on the open public web, preserve it, and then provide access to it. You might ask, why is that necessary? Doesn't the web sort of take care of itself? But in fact, as is well known, the lifespan of most material on the open web is relatively short, generally measured in terms of months, not even years. And there are also cases where things disappear for other, even malicious reasons. or political reasons, as we're seeing in the Middle East. As regimes change the way in which they represent themselves, which increasingly happens on the web, that changes. I remember we were involved with a project here in the US with the Library of Congress, tracking basically the federal government around the election 2 years ago. And I can tell you that the minute President Obama recited the oath of office, the White House website completely changed. And we have a copy of it before and a copy of it after. Also, DPR, that is our earlier repository solution, and we have about 8 years worth of content in various legacy collections there that we're also going to be bringing into Merit. Now, these various people were actually using Merit in a variety of ways. For some of this, including some of our legacy library holdings, Merit is being used as what we call a dark archive. It is essentially primarily there as a preservation copy, just in case, but there is really no intention or assumption that there'll be any direct end-user access to that material until it would become absolutely necessary. On the other hand, people interested in using Merit as a Bright Archive, both a preservation copy, but for which there is the intention to provide direct access. And we have been dealing with faculty members on a number of campuses, including here at Davis, particularly in regard to data management plans for NSF research. This next area, this is one that's very interesting, and we think that over the long term, this may turn out to be the most prevalent use of Merit, which is to function as a preservation backend for either existing or new discovery or content management systems that are already out there and will continue to run. So this is certainly the case with the CDL eScholarship program, our open access repository. They have their own discovery and delivery environment, and that'll continue in that in place. Similarly with the Minnesota Historical Society for the legislative data, Open Context has a very well-known web service for finding that archaeological data, and similarly with the research hub at Berkeley. We are also interested in working to integrate ourselves with a variety of distributed data grids. DataOne, we've already mentioned. We're working with folks down at UC San Diego, both in the libraries and at the San Diego Supercomputer Center, to integrate with their Chronopolis data grid, which is an SRB or IRODS now based data grid. And over in Germany, TextGrid is organized around social science data sets. And they're actually working with that in this last case, which is a local deployment of the Merit technology to build special purpose repositories on campus or elsewhere. So we at UC3, we offer Merit as a centrally hosted service, but we also make the underlying technology available.
John, if I could have you summarize a little bit to stay on schedule.
Okay, I think we're almost at the end here. Mm-hmm. The most important slide of all, what does it all cost? The Merit cost model is based solely on the amount of storage that is being used, and currently we charge that at $1,090 per terabyte per year. This represents our cost recovery. This is the price that we pay in order to procure that storage. And we think that is actually a very good price because we go out and we negotiate with the data centers on all 10 campuses, and even we're now starting to talk with some cloud-based providers in order to drive that cost down to the minimum it needs to be. So if we can summarize, we believe that Merit provides an innovative cost-effective solution for long-term curation. It lets you have direct control over your content, and well, those other things we've already sort of talked about. And then, if you want some more information, there are a variety of links here, or you can certainly talk to us later today or throughout the rest of the week. So, I think that is it for me. Are there any quick questions? Yes.
So
So merit is the website itself, or what is merit?
It is a repository service. There is a web environment that you can come to submit new information or to search for and retrieve information that is already being managed within it.
Okay, if it is a website, have you thought about the simplicity
and terminology used in presenting the site? We have, and we don't really have time to give you a demo here, but we think it is pretty easy. We've gotten very good reactions from our initial adopters in that regard. We did spend quite a lot of time doing usability studies in terms of the design of the UI. But I don't know, perhaps you're referring to some terminology I was just using in this talk, which I do have a tendency to go off and use jargon a little bit. Yes?
So this is when you're the charges for the, that's to put it in rather than to leave it in?
To
put the data in,
so
there's going to be a
charge. Represent?
Right?
Well, to leave it in. Yeah.
It's so when you someone stops paying, it disappears?
No. For us, we need to work to recover our costs somehow.
Right.
Storage is some cost. We know exactly what we have to pay for storage. So we use that as a pass-through. We charge $1,090 a terabyte. And the people that we are working with, even in the science community, we have found that people don't really get up to that terabyte level. A book, a digitized book, is about 6 cents. So a terabyte is a tremendous amount of data. And you're only charged for the storage use, and that's an annual charge. Our hope is that we can somehow miraculously have somebody within the university begin to pay for this type of collecting.
But I mean, it seems like it might be more sense to charge 100 times that to put it in, and then,
that's
20 times, 5%. Because clearly, people are going to run out of money, they're going to retire, it's got to be something that has legs beyond us. People being expected to pay every year.
Princeton is charging $8,000 for 500 gigabytes. Uh-huh. And
that's lifetime?
That's lifetime.
Yes.
And people have shot all kinds of holes in that. And so we are doing some cost modeling to see what that would look like for us.
Uh-huh.
So stay tuned.
Because,
we're hoping, we can hedge our bets and down the line, find ways to fund this. But I'm confident that we will.
It's certainly true that the trend line in the cost of storage is continues to go down.
Yeah, it's not the cost. It's the idea that people, the person who's paying attention stops paying attention.
Yeah.
Even if it's almost nothing.
Yeah.
If they don't pay their 2 cents, they disappear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The endowment model where you pay a big lump sum up front, that has certain attractive features to it, although there's some administrative problems. Technically, we're not allowed to carry forward endowment.
Yeah, yeah. That's at your end.
I was going to make a quick comment.
It's a quick comment.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So we worked with UC3 to put in an NIH proposal for data management. And so this interface is concerned about the jargon. I don't know. I wouldn't be too concerned about that. But the interface was pretty transparent and straightforward. But I was going to ask a question to Trish. You know what? We have a lot of data sets. I mean, some of them are huge, but some of them are like this digitized book. It's like 10 cents. I mean, what do you do? What if you have 100 files of these small files, which you want to archive, clearly, but I mean, they're just trivial relative to what your capacity is.
Yeah, I think, what we're finding in working with a lot of institutions, it's $6 a year. And so I think it's probably cost more money for us to bill for that.
Right.
Than not, but I think that's again, it's early days, and we would appreciate the conversation of is that something, a cost that the libraries absorb? I'm not sure once we start saving money on journals.
That starts tomorrow.
Yeah.
I
Alrighty, so next up we have Don Strong talking about the publisher's perspective on data archiving and publisher's requirements and so on.
Yeah,
and funding requirements.
The most extraordinary thing has happened. My brand new MacBook is packed up. And I thought that was impossible. So my faith is shattered.
That's because the new iPad was announced today, so they killed
it. But maybe if I can get, I mean, maybe if I do a scan, I know how to use these old timers here. I might be able to find my website. Oh, geez, this thing's. Oh, I'm still in a PowerPoint.
Go down.
Right?
Ignore it. Go to the E.
The E. Yeah, oh, I hate that. Isn't there?
The other side. Up. Yeah, but then
the other red X.
The red X.
To the right.
Oh, there it is. That'll maximize it. Okay. So I'd like to start by pointing out, and if I can get there, you can see that the Ecological Society of America has been has had a very a state-of-the-art in 2000 data archive since 2000, and we have published what are called data papers as well as a huge number of data supplements and data appendices to our published papers. And since the year 2000, we have advocated that every paper submit the data to this service. It was clear from the outset we could not afford to curate those data if every author did that. And it's only a small fraction of authors who have done that. And within the last month, the Ecological Society has, in its stately, other people would say glacial, way of taking on problems, has now required that one of our publications, Ecological Monographs, every submission is accompanied by a statement about how the author is going to preserve all of the data with a very formal sort of statement. We chose Ecological Monographs because we couldn't afford to do this for our other publications. We have, I think, about 6,000 publications a year, and Data One and Nascent, I believe, we have arrangement with what's the Nascent database called? Dryad. We have an arrangement with them such that we have a seat on the board, and every one of these publications that every one of these Ecological Monographs, we will pay Dryad $60, one-time cost. And the Ecological Society would be bankrupt within about 4 months if we required that for every publication. And this is part and parcel of this business of scientific societies moving into the modern age of open access online publishing, because the publishing model for open access is very, very different from the green eyeshade copy editor age that all of the August Ecological Society publications that you see right here are still in. And the reason we remain, except for the one on the left, Ecosphere, the reason we remain in this old-timey mode is that libraries pay us for each of these journals. And the libraries that I've talked to are quite happy to pay scientific societies for journals. They, per word, they cost one-tenth, one-one-hundredth of what commercial publishing costs. And so what the Ecological Society is trying to do, and this is a little bit beside the point for our topic today, is to move to this mode, Ecosphere, which is a journal that's only 8 months old now. It is open access. It's online only, digital only. It's PLOS One
model. User pays $1,250 for every accepted manuscript. And it's roaring along. But it's not roaring along anywhere near to the degree that Ecology is, for example, that had 75 submissions last week. And so the tension that I understand there are other societies like this, like the Soil Science Society is facing very similar issues. The Genetic Society is facing very similar issues. The tension is, how do societies that don't have the resources of commercial publishers move into the digital age? And to start this new journal, the Ecological Society, which is actually a very healthy, prosperous scientific society, borrowed a huge amount of money against future revenues. And so the issue of getting back that we're talking about today, of supporting our servers, of having, and I'm going to take you there, if I can find it.
Data archives?
Yes.
Where is it? Scroll up a bit.
I can't see the screen. Where's data archives?
It's up a bit and on the right hand side.
Up
on
the right hand side.
You have to scroll up.
Oh, okay. See, it would not been revealed as a
incompetent.
There it is. Okay, we are there. So the Ecological Society, this is largely the work of Aaron Ellison and Bob Peet, started the archives in the year, they came online in the year 2000. And they faced all of the issues that you professionals have faced. So some of the first stuff were PDFs. Well, they don't migrate. So we had to then go away from PDF. And now I think, as I understand, the newest software will migrate PDF, but I don't know that's true, and I don't know the details about it. And all of these kinds of things cost the Ecological Society money. Hiring thoroughly modern people to work in the publications office who are trained in information technology, and instead of the old style, a PhD in English. And some of our newest hires have both. And so these are some of the challenges. So let me show you what we do here. Okay, so this is sort of the guts of what we have done since the year 2000. And here they are. The editor of Ecological Archives is Bill Michener, who's a big mover in Data One and Dryad. And we have had papers published that are simply data papers, or data papers accompanying orthodox standard papers since the year 2000. And you can go look at some of these, and they're thoroughly unremarkable. But they require, I mean, once you look at them, but then they, at the same time, they are thoroughly remarkable because of the effort that people like David and Deborah Clark put in to making those data usable in perpetuity to everybody. And so the issue that you raise, if you have high metadata standards, people simply won't do it. What you see in this sequence of about 125 data papers are people who were motivated to do it. And others have said they're going to do it and never did, and the data never appeared. So we are at this situation where we're about ready to start requiring a second journal to deposit data, and we don't know which one it is. We don't have the money to do it yet. It will not be Ecology because there are too many papers. It will probably be, my guess is it'll be Ecological Applications.
So yes. Given the journals already have page charges, the majority of them do. Mm-hmm. Is there thought of passing the cost of data archiving onto the author in a similar way to page charges?
I have the privilege of listening to the business office talk about these mm-hmm. kinds of things once a year at the annual meeting, and yes. So these our journals, the money that comes to the Ecological Society for our publications and supports the society, and it supports the annual ESA meeting, without which commercial publishers wouldn't have any place to tout their stuff. But at any rate, and it's a lot of money. And so the way forward will be something like, it is not going to be increasing charges to libraries, I can tell you that. So factoring that money in will probably be in page charges. But given that the society is 120 years old, the governing board is a little bit older than that on average. And the changes at the Ecological Society, I'm considered a youngster. The changes at the Ecological Society are very slow and very deliberate. And so I believe that it will be, I think you have put your finger on it, it will be that the page charges of that journal are simply incremented by the cost of putting those data in Dryad. But we're going to go on for a couple of years, I imagine, with the ecological monographs model, and see how it works. Yes.
And the point about raising page charges to pay for data archiving is, if you have a model where there are already page charges, it's easy to add on to that. If you have a model where there are no page charges and a journal is purely a commercial venture, then that doesn't end up working in the same way.
That's very interesting. I've heard that kind of argument from our business office people in reference to other changes.
Right.
I think that's very interesting to hear you say that, because you come from the other side of the street.
I'm working with a commercial publisher, right. And so the kind of problems with introducing charges for data archiving are a little bit different,
right.
And in some ways they end up being not very compatible with society, but it's quite likely that if a large society such as ESA was to move forward with compulsory data archiving for papers, then commercial publishers may follow suit. And that's certainly what happened with the American Society of Naturalists and Evolutionary Journals.
I should say that one thing that was said earlier, that the Whitlaw movement, or the Whitbach Initiative, was about 2006, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I just showed you that the Ecological Society has been doing this since the year 2000.
Yeah.
But it could not do it as a requirement for all papers. It was simply an urging.
But given there's something like Dryad, authors could go there individually, correct?
There's always that choice. Yes.
And so a commercial publisher might say, yes, with this requirement, yet you go to Dryad and you pay whatever they charge for it.
Absolutely.
Or a granting agency would require it. The paper would be published in a commercial journal, and the author would do it to satisfy what the granting agency required. Mm-hmm. Probably, that's maybe a little bit less likely, but it's...
Depends on the granting agency.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly some are more likely to do that than others.
That's right. I think the NSF is trying to go that way. I don't know what the... but their sort of indecision seems to me to be... that they seem to be almost as conservative as the Ecological Society.
I think the NSF would be the least likely to require something.
Right. Because of
they will recommend it.
But it's very different to, for example, the British Natural Environmental Research Council is going to require data archiving, and it's going to require archiving its archive. And so it's providing an archive explicitly for that purpose.
Whereas it seems with groups like the National Science Foundation, there's more of a, there's less of a willingness to put up the funds to provide that archive. Rather, they're trying to lead by funding groups like Data Dryad, Data One, the our own CDL folks, and so on. So it's,
I mean, people, I think everyone here appreciates the fact that in the last, certainly the last 20 years, the world of the responsibility for the preservation of scientific information has changed in a way that reverses the previous 1,500 years. The libraries at Asser Barnapal were the same model that we had when I was an associate professor. It was paper in a building with librarians taking care of paper. And that model is changing extremely rapidly now. And this is part and parcel of that model. You know, this fellow, this wise guy who writes for Scientific America named Sherman, wrote a book in the early 90s, a claim that stunned me when I saw it because I hadn't thought about it, and now it's ridiculous. It's almost banal that 90% of the science that had been done has been done in the last decade. And as well, there's a positive feedback with the rate at which data can be generated. And so it's not like, oh, that's the same kind of science, there's just a lot more of it that we had in 1930. It's a kind of science now that generates data at exponentially increasing rates.
Not necessarily knowledge.
That's correct. My son is a statistician with the Bank of America, and he showed me a talk that they had, and they're very, very concerned about very, very concerned about data. And they actually have seminar series, and they had a talk with an academic who analyzes Twitter data. And I watched the online thing. And the first thing he said is, it would be inconceivable for any institution to store any small fraction of this data. It goes by, and we have to make of it what we will, and there's no way to store it, there's just too much of it. That was the beginning of this statement. And so, think about it. And it's not, you know, it's not the only kind of data like that. Yes?
About ecological archives and these data papers, what are the sort of publishing standards for a data paper? I have a data set that I think might be useful for someone.
We can look at those.
Well, put it, we try to submit it in that sense.
We can.
Or
you can. What you do, and I could do it instantly if I was on my own machine. It's ESAPubs, ESAPubs.org. Let's see if I can get there.
We should move on, Jen, or behind.
Let's see if it takes us there, and I'll show you where you can look it up. I didn't get it quite right. If you log on as if you were going to submit a new paper, you'll be taken to, it says authors and author instructions, and just click, 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 and there it is.
Is there a charge for publishing a data paper?
There are page charges, yes.
Yeah,
okay. No, wait. There are no page charges because it's not published in paper.
Okay.
I don't know.
I think the landscape is changing very fast for what to do in these cases. For example, there have been a lot of discussions about expanding the DOI data publication portion of papers such that a paper might represent a bunch of linked objects, including a data object as well as some other objects, and then the data object is very powerful because that becomes the sort of central part of multiple papers. And so I think, you know, in the next couple of years, there's going to be a creative explosion of different ways to present the scientific publication, of which one of them that's unquestionably going to grow is just the data publication part.
Okay. Okay, we should probably move on to Robert Hyman's, who's talking about types and levels of archiving.
Yeah, I thought my question was why archive, really, but I wasn't sure.
Yes,
it said two things. And so I only have some very general comments. I don't have either a position at a renowned organization like ESA, or do I develop these beautiful interfaces that we've looked at to store data. I guess most of my experience is indeed in the struggle to deal with disparate data sets, maybe collected decades ago, perhaps still available on paper or just gone, just looking or not, you know, trying to find the traces and try to bring it together. And so for one general comment is that, you know, we're in this cultural change to try to make this better, it seems. That's why we're here together. Or are we? Don just said that, you know, libraries are your central for 1500 years or longer. I don't know, no longer if you go back to Alexandria, I suppose, but all of a sudden their role has changed. At the same time, you know, data publishing is something that scientists have always done and did much more in the past. You know, if they go back to Vavilov or Gauss or classical data sets, they have already published. And I think it's because indeed there were a few scientists that had a lot of time and they published much less and much more reports. So that changed maybe in the 50s or so. I don't know when exactly, I haven't studied this. Short, brief papers, a whole different model, no space for data anymore. But there's really nothing new. So there are practical reasons now we can do it again electronically. The question is how. Really, that's I guess what we're up to. So I wanted to say just a couple of general words about why, and I think it's pretty self-evident, so I won't take much of your time. But I got a couple of keywords: repeatability. Yeah, that seems to be number one. Science just isn't good science if you can't repeat it. And I think the way I was taught it meant you should be able to go out there again and plant the same, you know, crop of wheat or attack the same salamander and see if they do the same thing. That's one way to think about it. Another way to think about it is obviously, well, you know, if I have the same data and they run the same analysis, do I come to the same conclusions? Not being able to do that has been very frustrating for me in many ways as a researcher, as a reviewer. You know, I also review papers that I just have to believe and trust but verify just doesn't apply. So that seems to be an extremely important thing to solve. As a researcher, it's more, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants. The scientific process of being able to, you know, take what has been done and go forward just isn't in existence right now. Another big thing is just, you know, people, we've talked about meta-analysis, and that's a very important aspect, but the idea of, you know, old data, new questions, particularly important now with climate change and global change, where people into sort of, you know, reinterpret or revisit certain experiments, certain observations that were done in the past, but you can only do it if you have the opportunity to compare with previously collected data, the raw data, not just the summaries, in most cases. You know, somebody mentioned that there had been a survey was done on the scientists, researchers, to, you know, to hear about their opinion about all of this, and often you get a lot of defensive responses, I find. Like, well, I get scooped, I get this, I get that. That's there, but I think a very important point to make here is that there are so many ways that this can improve the way we do science. You know, many of my colleagues, and including myself, you're always afraid to get scooped and that our data gets stolen or misrepresented, was that the word I hear? The real big problem is that we all lose our data. And I think, yeah, Marcel, you mentioned that, and I've had that problem. But moreover, you know, I made a note here. I should say, you know, to use the term science 2.0. But I was happy to learn that Merritt uses this analogy as well from what did he use, the Flickr site. So we have all these new communicative tools out there in social networking. Why can't we use those in science to bring data together, start working on them, and somehow link that to the publication process? People have talked about this for quite a while. I don't think I need to really convince any of us here that data preservation is important. The question is very much also how to get there. There have been huge successes. GenBank, for example. GBIF is another one, if you're familiar with those repositories, particularly where data are relatively simple, uniform. In other domains, much less success. And so how to get there is an important question, and that's why I find this workshop very interesting, because we have these journal editors here. I don't think that journals have the role and are equipped necessarily, and that's what the editors here say, to do long-term storage, but clearly they have the stick, or the carrot, however you want to call it. We all want to publish in the top journals. So they can really make it happen. They have much more disability than NSF or anyone else to say, well, yeah, this is just part of the scientific process. If you're a player of the global public scientific endeavor, this is how we do business. And then how it should be done, and the different forms and shapes it should go in, I think that's going to be very different between fields. And the interesting thing we see now is all these programs and projects coming up. And as far as I'm concerned, you just let kind of a thousand flowers flower and see, let the winners emerge and see how it goes by field. But they will emerge. It will happen. One final comment, perhaps, about sort of, just out of my own experience, also the meta-analysis and the role of people in data curation and scientists in data curation. I mean, the idea of just storing everything and say, oh, now it's available and you can extract it and do all this analysis is, in many cases, highly naive. Particularly if you have a liberal approach to storage, like, oh, you can upload whatever you want, even if there's no metadata. Although I understand and I subscribe to that way, at least to get going until there's no way back, and then you can have actually tight rules. But what I've learned is that there's a tremendous amount of time in actually bringing data together, linking data, and again, so it has to do with, well, okay, it was uploaded in this form, and now I actually reshaped it so it's more clear, and I annotated it. Where can I leave that? It's no longer my data. Is it a new version of the same data? Collections, linking data across the internet and in these different repositories. That aspect, I haven't heard anyone talk about much, and that seems in my own life, I've sort of done a lot of work, and now I have it, what do I do with it? But perhaps that's just a natural next step in many of these initiatives. So those are my brief words. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. I don't think that's anything that merits really questions. Any discussion?
At a meeting once, a paleontologist said to me, he says, you people are so anal about this data thing. He says, we are losing the information we have at a tremendous rate as the Earth erodes. And if you talk, and he went on to say, she went on to say that linguists are losing the basic data that they would have to interpret the world at a tremendous rate as people simply stop speaking their languages or assimilate into other groups. And he says that the model that we should be concerned about isn't preserving everything perfectly, and he finished up, he says, it's salvage archaeology. That's what you're doing. And that's the way you should be thinking about it. And so what does someone in informatics like yourself think about that, or dataology, think about that attitude?
Dataology. Well, I don't have one single response to it, but one thing you brings to mind is also that, like, well, we can of course store everything in love if we don't really want. And that's a big question. Should we just keep adding to it or not? But is it in ecology, say, is it more important to worry about losing data, or is it more important to not doing observations on losing organisms? I mean, that would be the corollary, I suppose. I don't know.
Do to the degree there are trade-offs, it becomes an easier question. When you do have a simple a trade-off like you have just set up, then one can logically analyze the situation. But I think that the people from CBO, for example, they're talking, it's not clear that there's a trade-off. Mm. They're trying to come up with enough money to do something that many people think is an intelligent, reasonable way to go forward in the future. But there aren't clear alternatives, it seems to me. It's get as much of it as you can, and it's as much a psychological endeavor as anything else.
I think generally also there's really no additional cost to all of this. I mean, of course, if you know, these people have to do this, they'll have to charge for it. But I just believe that it will make everything, you know, as a general endeavor, it will make science just more cost effective. Just the money flow has to change a bit. But my life will be easier. I can be more productive because I have these mechanisms. And, so it's not going to be more expensive. In that sense, there's no trade-off. It's just that, you know, who's going to pay? Maybe the library has something else with the same money, or you know, it's always a fight. But
yeah, well, look, I mean, some of this has expiration date, so it's not either preserved in perpetuity or not. Simply you get 30, 60, 90 day. Or you could 5 years, just like your bank statements, you throw away after a while. And so I think there's some things that you could preserve. I mean, video, say seminars or something. Some of these you might want to keep on file for 30, 60 days, and then discard others, maybe for permanent archives. So anyway, you have that whole rating, I would think.
Do you think we know? Is enough to determine what's going to be useful.
Some of it's going to be a close call. Others, you'll see life is just
So, I mean, I think that the fundamental thing to focus on is what is the point of storing the data. And the point is to, you know, do these things like reproducibility and to allow for accelerated pace of scientific discovery and sharing. By the fact that you don't have to redo the experiment and you can share the data and make use of it. And I think that the cost, if the cost is such that you compromise your ability to do other things simply because you're archiving the data, then it doesn't make, we need to think about the whole field of science at once. And I would argue that, I mean, I was going to say this in a few minutes, but I would argue that, you know, the data is just one object. The knowledge is actually in the papers. We have to make the papers available to everybody. If we're making the data available and not the knowledge, that's just stupid. And you have to make the tools available. And, you know, museums have been making the resources in many cases available that are behind a lot of things, through voucher specimens and things like that. But it's the whole package. And the data is, we can't obsessively focus on the data. And I'll just give you one example. In DNA sequencing now, the new Illumina machine can generate a terabase of data. It is cheaper to redo the experiment in many cases than it is to transfer and store the data in some cases. So,
the biologic material might be hard to get to.
There are issues there, right? So I think that we need to think of the whole package here, not just one little part of it.
Yeah.
Our normalist gives a departmental seminar or has the room at 4.
Okay. Okay. Manana, huh?
Ah.
We come back manana at
same time.
We'll carry on tomorrow. Sorry we went a little bit off schedule. We'll do our best to catch up.